The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2023, Charting the Course, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join. or by making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, please visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Thanks everyone for having us.
The co-lead of Big Code. And we've been working on that for the past 6 months. And I think I'll hand over back to you so you can get us started.
Yeah. The next slide, maybe. Yeah, I don't think this is gonna, like, this used to be video, but I don't think this is gonna work here. So I'm just gonna start with saying, like, yeah, we've seen a lot of excitement around what we call like code LLMs, code large language models. So products like GitHub Copilot, but also Amazon's Code Whisperer are really, really making a big impact very fast on professional developers. I'm just gonna trust that you've already seen one of these systems in actions, right? Like how they are able to, write code from commons or like just complete code snippets. But if you haven't seen it, we'll probably show some of that later in this talk. Next slide, please. Oh yeah, that's coming. Yeah, and what we've been seeing, right, like for Copilot, just a bunch of like impressive numbers just to show you how fast of an adoption we've seen. Like they're already Microsoft reported over 1 million subscribers. They report that they complete a certain task 55% faster. And also some of the, they claim that up to 46% of the code generated by professional developers is actually written by these AI assistants. So there's no doubt that there is just like so much, like some super fast impact on the professional developers. Cool, next slide. Right, so given all this excitement, and also concerns about this technology. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about like how we've approached like as a Big Code community, the development of these models. And before we dive into that, we briefly going to touch upon like LLMs 101. So like what are these systems, like how are they built a little bit to give you a bit of the background. And then we move into like how, what the Big Code community is, the data set that we've created that we call the stack, and sort of like the latest model that we produced, StarCoder. Right, next slide. So let's start with LLMs. So yeah, before we dive into all the details, I'm assuming that a lot of people have heard about a lot of large language models, maybe a Llama or GPT-3 or ChatGPT, for example, right? Like a lot of people have played with these systems. And it's like worth noting that when we create these systems, there are really different stages of creation of these models, right? So we start usually with what we call the pre-training stage. And that's what we're gonna focus on really on today, like how this pre-training works. But then there are later stages called instruction tuning or RLHF that take these what we call base models and then align them with human preferences in some sense. So we be trying to make them follow better the instructions that people care about. And so for BigCode so far, we've been focusing on pre-training, and instruction tuning and the RLHF parts are a little bit excluded today. If you're interested in that, I'm just putting some reference to other talks if you're interested in that. Cool. Maybe next slide. Cool. Yeah. So let's go to, what's this pre-training stage? What are generative pre-trained transformers? And if you go back really to the core, we basically it's based on a very simple objective, what we call next word prediction. So let's say we have a sentence, as in this example, my name is Harm. What we usually do is when we have this sentence, we first split it into tokens. So in this case, I just split it into words. So my name is Harm. And then what we do, so we convert those tokens into, we have a vocabulary of tokens, and usually these are around 50,000 tokens. And then, so we convert these words into really integers into this vocabulary. And then what the training objective here is that we, for this current token here in purple, you can see the next token is the target. And to the model is at this purple stage, the context is all the previous tokens that are occurring before. So it's here in gray. And then we pass it on to what we call a transformer architecture. And this transformer architecture is basically only looking back to the context before through a couple of neural network layers, and then it predicts it outputs the probability distribution over the tokens again. And what we're trying to do is so we have here for a probability distribution over 50,000 tokens, and we're trying to make this probability distribution output the target token, or more, make that more likely, in this case, Harm. And so this is a little bit, I just showed this for one token, but this is actually happening for a context window of around 2000 tokens, and each step, is only looking back to the previous tokens and batched up during training. Next slide. Right. And training then is just if you imagine the transformer that we just had, we start with random weights, and from so we have a outputting really random probability distributions for the tokens. And then what we do is during training, we update the weights, we make tiny updates to the weights such that at each step we make it more likely it's outputting the next target token. And this is really happening at a very, very large scale. So we start, here you can see the typical training curve. You start with a very high loss, so you're not doing very well in the task, but by just iterating over lots and lots of amount of data, you actually get better at this training objective. And just to give you appreciation of the sheer scale of this operation, right? This is, for StarCode, what we're talking about, we will be training typically on 500 GPUs for, over 20 days. And this is really approaching $1 million in compute costs. Another example is Llama, the 65 billion parameter model, which was trained on over 2000 GPUs for over 20 days, right? And this is really in the millions of dollars of pure compute cost we're talking about just to create the base model. Next slide. Yeah, and you know, this is a little bit sort of like an underappreciated effect, I think, about the learning objective. So next word prediction sounds a very simple, like innocent learning objective. But if you start to think a little bit about it, like you will notice that it actually, to do well on this task, you need to have like a lot of, you know, diverse knowledge and understanding about the world. I mean, so one simple example is you need to have linguistic knowledge, right? Like about if something is plural or not. You need to have some common sense knowledge, right? About, for example, capitals of countries. You also need to have some reasoning capabilities in certain cases, like here, for example, where Bill has 5 chocolate bars and gives 3 to Gina, Bill now has 2 chocolate bars, right? In order to predict as well, you need to be able to reason over the previous tokens. Next slide, please. And this is also true for source code, right? So if you look at source code, and you often start with maybe, well, at least in Python, like a function definition, and then maybe duck string. And if you then trying to complete the next couple of tokens, you actually need to predict code from a duck string, right? So this is an implicit task you're learning through this next word prediction. And here and on the right, we'll actually see an even more interesting example, I think. And that is you, in certain cases, you need to learn how to execute code. So if you have here a Jupyter notebook, and we have a caption show all odd numbers in my array, and we then have the actual code to do that, and we ask then the model to complete that, right? So like to generate the output, you basically ask the model to act as an interpreter. So in some sense, there is like, yeah, as you can see, it's a very diverse objective depending on what kind of data you feed into it. Next slide. Right. This is like was a little bit about like the training and an objective, but one of the breakthroughs or most interesting things that was observed about when we scale up these models is what we call in-context learning. So this was really shown by the GPT-3 paper first. And what in-context learning means is that we can, after we've trained these models, what we often can do is we just give it a description of the task we want to do. For example, translate English to French. And we call this like zero shot if there are no examples. And if we add examples to this prompt, like, so here are a couple of examples of English words to French translations. So the more we add these examples to the prompt, the better our model becomes, right? So it learns in context to adapt to the task. And this is really quite fascinating behavior of these models. And it's really opened up these models to people who are not machine learning engineers, right, who don't know how to train these models. They could actually play around with these models for prompting them. Right, so the big picture here, and what we'll talk about today is, when you start training large language models, so you really start with scraping like lots amounts of data from the internet, usually from like places like GitHub or Wikipedia. A lot of time is spent on creating and cleaning those data sets. And then we just feed it into like a big expensive training run. And then we end up with a model that we can prompt or easily adapt to all these different tasks that we care about. Cool. And so this is like the big picture to keep in mind. And I think then it's time to move into the big code efforts, Leandro.
Sure. So the Big Code project is something that we started planning probably a year ago or over a year ago now, and really kicked off 6 months ago. And the main objective of the project was to do, like a lot of these models that are very performant, they're very closed source. Nobody really knows what kind of data goes into training them and how to build them. So we wanted to do this as a like a community effort. Maybe some of you heard of Big Signs, which was a project preceding Big Code, which did that for natural language. And we wanted to do that specifically for code to see, can we build like a very performant code model in the open with the community? To illustrate a bit like how big Big Code is, how the big comes into code. Right now, I think there are over 500 participants in Big Code from like many different countries. On the right-hand side, you can see the author list of StarCoder, where you can see all the people that like very actively contributed to StarCoder. And you can see they come from very different backgrounds, different institutions. And it was an exciting endeavor to do this in the open with so many people that just helped us kind of in their free time building this model. What we found, and probably a lot of people already knew before, like developing code models for code LLMs is not only like a technical problem. There are also a lot of problems relating to data governance, for example. One important point is the consent of data subjects. The data that's needed to train these models to become performant and competitive with some of the closed source models is enormous. You need terabytes of data to train good models at that scale. There are open questions like, do machine learning models need to comply with copyright law? What kind of licenses should go into the model? And how can like people maybe who don't want to participate in that effort opt out? There's a lot of concerns about privacy. When you train a lot these large models on a lot of data, they pick up all kinds of patterns from their pre-training data, so they can memorize, for example, PII, personal identifiable information, and you can abuse what Harm showed before with the in-context learning and prompt these models to generate, for example, PII that they've seen. For example, if you give them a few examples of like password equals and then some passwords, and you prompt a model like that, it might generate passwords that were in the pre-training data and could be abused. There's also a lot of open questions about software safety and security. On the one hand, code LLMs are not perfect. They might generate code that's, I mean, in the best case, it just doesn't work. But in the worst case, it works, but maybe it integrates some known vulnerabilities. But even more extreme, if someone has like bad intent, they can use such code models to generate malware and to cause harm. So these are some of the concerns that are beyond just training the models on lots of data that go into building such a thing. We tried to document and summarize and also explain how we addressed some of these in a governance card that should give you an overview of all these aspects and how we worked on them. As I said, like there is a trend currently that most of these models are closed. Many of the best models are just available through an API, which has like a lot of limits, poses a lot of limits for researchers. So they can't really probe the models for safety and alignment. Don't have access to their inner workings. You can only see what comes out at the end, essentially. You can only see the outputs of the API. But you don't have any access to the internal state of the models, and you can't do the cool things that a lot of people are currently doing, which is adaptation, like instruction tuning or RLHF, because that would require having access to the prompts, to the weights, not the prompts. Even when we started big code, there were already some open models like CodeChain and Encoder, but even they had very limited amount of information on the training data. And sometimes the big tech companies, they might release some models like Llama or CodeChain, but one thing they rarely release, even rarer, is the training data. So that makes it very hard to reproduce. So you don't know exactly what they did on the model. The only thing you know is maybe if they add some information about the filtering and so on in the paper, but often they lack that information to really reproduce it. One problem that we faced a lot was we wanted to evaluate some of the closed source models, but we were never sure if the benchmark that we're currently evaluating was already in the pre-training data. One thing that we could do, because we created a data set before training, we could filter out all the benchmarks that we knew we wanted to evaluate later on. But for all the closed source models, we don't know if they were trained on them, and we don't have any way of checking. Even if they claim they've been removed, the only thing that we have kind of is their word for it. And then going back to like the data concerns, it's like people don't have any way to know how their data was used, if their data was used, and there is certainly no way to remove it. And then to do open and responsible research, we looked into what is necessary to distribute the training data. We filtered the data set for permissive licenses only. That's all the data that went into the stack that Harm's going to talk about a bit later. We also worked on tools to inspect the collected data and potentially opting out. And to build trust in systems like that, we try to be as transparent as possible about all the limitations of the things we were doing. Whenever you do PII detection, for example, you're limited by how good your detector is, and how we build like specific data sets and models to be as good as possible. But still, there might be PII in the data set. But the way we try to address these concerns is being transparent about it and giving like the community the tools to potentially improve those things in the future. Another thing to signal like the limitations of the code LLMs, we have extensive model cards that point out what things you can do and what things the model was designed to do, and potentially what some shortcomings are, like the model can produce code with bugs, it can produce vulnerabilities. And we try to address some of the abuse, potential abuses in the OpenRail license, which is a license that permits commercial use and distribution and modification of the model, but it comes with a set of use case restrictions that prohibit the user from doing certain things, for example, generate malware. With that, I give back to Harm to talk a bit more about the data set, the stack that we released a few months ago.
Yeah, exactly. So so with all these considerations in mind, like we started or like the BigCode project really started with the release of the stack. And it was already, I mean, we already started working on that, I mean, a long, long time before we announced the collaboration in September and released the dataset in October. It just took us, I think, almost like 8-9 months to you know, get this data and get it ready. Maybe go to the next slide, Leandro. So let me first tell like what the stack is, right? So the stack is our pre-training data set for source code. It's like consists of over 6 terabytes of data. It's all permissively licensed, and I'll come back in a second to why we made this decision. I mean, we cover over 358 programming languages. So really, we just took whatever was on GitHub and used sort of like standard programming language, you know, classification just to classify all the, well, just use the extension to get all these diverse programming languages. And then I think the interesting thing is that we provide what we call a data inspection tool and an opt-out mechanism. So what this means, we'll talk about later, is that we, you know, provide transparency on which data we have collected from you. So you can check for your GitHub handle what is in the, like, if your data is in our data set, and we give a way to remove that data from the data set before we start training. And maybe for about permissive licenses, right? Like, we, I think it could be an interesting discussion afterwards. But sort of like the main reason we chose to go with that was that we knew there was like quite some, some pushback from the copyleft community on using their data for training. And we were like, okay, let's first put like, for the data that we have, just choose the ones that have, you know, the most permissively licensed data to go with. And then we'll figure out later, sort of like, and we'll talk about that, like how the community really feels about this and what we can do to improve the situation of like content creators, and what kind of new mechanisms need to be developed to, you know, build better systems that, you know, incorporate LLMs, but also incentivize or like, you know, distribute sort of like one of the gains back to content creators. Cool. Next slide, please. So this slide is just give you a rough sense of like how we collected this data set. I mean, it's all about the sheer scale of operations here, right? Like, we, you know, collected first over 220 million repository names from like GitHub Archive. Then we cloned all those repositories, right? Like, only leading to over 100 terabytes of data. We selected some file extensions that we thought were most useful, and then run the license detector over all those files or all those repositories, and finally also ran near deduplication, right? And these are what we refer to the stack. We kind of come in two versions. Like, one is the raw version, which is over 6 terabytes, and then the nearly deduplicated version, which is nearly 3 terabytes of data. Cool. And I was already mentioning this. The interesting part about the stack is that we do have a Hugging Face space where people can check, here's my GitHub handle. Well, like, what kind of repositories did you collect is in the stack? And from there, once you find your repositories, we have now a way to immediately remove that by submitting a ticket to, or like an issue to, our opt-out repository on GitHub, and just by verifying that it's the right username, we sort of like automatically can remove your data for the next release. Cool. In the process, I think this is quite interesting. We learned a lot about how people felt about using their data, right? Like, we first had an opt-out form where people could provide feedback for why they want to opt out. I'm just going to go over some of the feedback we got, because I think there's a lot of interesting things in there. One is like, people thought that it should be opt-in instead of opt-out. Some people were, or like, so found unfair that we were using their code without any compensation, right? They got the feeling that other people were monetizing their creations, and that money didn't flow back. Some people were concerned that there's PII in their code, like in their code, and they don't want it to be publicly exposed, and that's why they opted out. Next one is an interesting one. Yeah, we're back. Some people thought that their code is of poor quality and not suitable for training our AI model, so that's why they want to opt out. And the last one is, I'm not so confident about the current state of AI code generation, and I'm afraid that, you know, generated code can be traced back to my repositories and I'm held liable for issues in that code in some form. I think we lost Leandro. Okay, so I think like I do have like, so there was also, so this is the feedback we got back from the opt-out form. Jennifer Ding at the Turing Institute also conducted some community research, basically from people who are at the Turing Institute and whose code was in our data set. And see from a couple of interviews, the sort of like general lesson she took back was that no one had a really strong desire to opt out, but they felt it is both better to know that their data is in the data set and better to have a choice. Right. So there they did feel very positive about like this transparency about the data rather than completely ignoring this aspect as, you know, what's the default these days in OLM development. Cool. Next slide. I think you're back, Leandro, just in time to go to StarCode, and I'll pass it on to you.
Thanks. Yeah, just a small hiccup. Yeah, let me talk about StarCoder, which is kind of the culmination of the first phase of BigCode, the target of building a large language model that's performant for code. Before I tell you the results, I wanted to quickly talk about like the data process. So most of the things here we already talked about. We used the stack as the starting point for the training data. We applied very strong unification. We found that consistently gives us the best performance. We tried a lot of things for filtering the data set, like GitHub stars or common to code ratio. But in our ablation studies, like the only thing that's always good is unification. And for example, in the case of GitHub stars, if you filter by them, it actually hurts performance rather than improving. On top of that, we try to be very inclusive with languages, but training on 350 languages in parallel poses some challenges. There's like at some point you'll be limited by the capacity of the model. So we try to find a middle ground between just training on, I don't know, Python and Java and JavaScript and training on all languages. And we came to like roughly 80 programming languages that were one popular and two not data, didn't contain too much data files. In addition to the languages, we also included GitHub issues, commits, and structured Jupyter notebooks. Especially the latter are very interesting in the example that Tarn showed earlier, where you have an interesting structure of text, code, and the result of code execution. And we thought that's like an interesting thing to train on. On top of near deduplication, we ran data quality inspections to improve the quality of the data set. And for each extension that was in the data set of these 86 languages, every language can have multiple extensions in principle. For each extension, we looked at least 100 samples and we tried to derive filters where the quality wasn't very good. For example, a common thing is either, as I said earlier, there some extensions are shared with data extensions where instead of code, you just have like data in there, like raw text, for example, or I don't know, a table, or auto-generated code or auto-generated things. So we applied heuristics to remove those. To remove PII, we faced the challenge that first of all, there is not really a PII data set to train a PII model. So what we had to do first is we had to create a PII data set, which we did in a crowdsourcing effort. And that data set we also released so other similar efforts can train and evaluate their PII removal strategies. We released a model called StarPII, which is a model that can detect names, emails, and passwords in bits of code. And we ran that model like on the whole data set, which in itself was quite an endeavor and took quite a bit of resources to apply at data set scale. I'm gonna skip over that. So we try to take a little bit of different route from how people usually make architecture choices. If you're like an academic group, usually the main goal is just to build a model that's as performant as possible. But we also try to think about what is are the properties of such a model that people want when they use it for the use cases, which might be slightly different from what's necessary to just achieve very high performance on some benchmarks. One is obviously people want very fast inference, because if you want to integrate something like that into an IDE and you need to wait a couple of seconds, users will quickly stop using such an extension because it will feel very laggy. We wanted to build a system that you can use to do cheap generations. If you deploy such a model to serve an extension, you will get like lots of requests and potentially very long sequences, and traditionally they require lots of memory. We also want to have very long contexts, because the more context you can provide to the model, for example, all the code that's before, and maybe even code from surrounding files in the repositories, that's going to take a lot of space. So we want to have a model that can deal with a large amount of text. And especially for code, it's important to have bidirectional context. So Harm showed at the very beginning how these LLM works, where you predict the next token, and as a context or as an input, the model always gets the previous tokens. But for example, when you are in a extension, in a IDE, and your cursor is at a certain point in your code and you want to predict what comes next, maybe the method or class that you need to use is actually defined further down the code. So you want to also include that in the context. So you want to have actual bidirectional context rather than just everything that's above. And to address these, we came up with the following set of properties. We went for a medium-sized model. 50 billion parameters is very large if you think about like a few years ago how large that would have been, but it's quite small compared to like some of the newest models that are out there. And we've worked a lot of code optimizations to make inference even faster. We used a technique called multi-query attention, which makes generating much cheaper because it reduces the memory footprint to generate text much smaller. We also used a technique that's called flash attention to scale the model context to 8,000 tokens. That's significantly more than most of the open available models, which are between 1 and 2,000 tokens normally. The communities and the research labs are quickly catching up, and there are now some closed source models and some open models that also have like very large contexts. And for the bidirectional context, we went for a trick that's called FIM, or fill in the middle. That allows you to use a model that can just generate from left to right by rearranging the data slightly. So you can imagine you're somewhere in the middle of a text, and you have a prefix, which is everything that comes before, and you have a suffix, which is everything that comes after the current position, and you want to predict something in the middle. Fill in the middle just does a small rearrangement where it takes the prefix, then the suffix, and then you predict what comes in the middle. So it's just like a little bit of shuffling of the data, which allows you to predict something in the middle, even though you can only see things on the left. That's kind of a neat data trick that you can do without actually changing the architecture of the model. I'm gonna skip over that. For the training setup, once we decided what architecture to use, the training setup was fairly straightforward. We had some infrastructure we could use consisting of 500 GPUs. One of the main difficulties when training models like that is they don't really fit on a single GPU anymore for training. So you need to distribute the model across many GPUs, and there's different strategies, model distribution strategies. I'm not gonna go into details here, but we used like a combination of tensor pipeline and data parallelism to make this work. We went for a fairly large batch size of 4 million tokens for a single optimization batch, and we trained for 1 trillion tokens in total. That corresponds to roughly 250,000 optimization steps. The training took 24 days in total. As you can see on the right, the sailing was fairly smooth. You see a multicolored graph because we had some restarts or interruptions, but they were mostly automatically resuming. So what happens if you have 500 GPUs and you use them heavily for 24 days is you get hardware failures where a GPU just dies at some point and you need to replace it. And that's where the color changes essentially in that graph. But it didn't require much manual intervention. The tool we use to train the model at scale in a distributed fashion is called Megatron LM. We have a custom fork of Megatron that includes these techniques I mentioned earlier called multi-query attention and flash attention. The result of this is a set of two models, star-coded base, which is exactly the model I described before, trained on 1 trillion tokens on 80 languages, and star-coder, which is a model that's been trained a little bit more on top of star-coded base on just Python. We found that the community is most excited about Python, and we wanted to provide a model that's very performant at Python, but in principle, people could do the same thing for other languages. As you can see, training 35 billion tokens on top of 1 trillion tokens is like just a 3% of the full compute budget. So it's relatively cheap compared to the full training. To know how good the model actually is, we ran it on some benchmark. There is a popular benchmark called Human Eval. Essentially, the model gets a function signature plus a doc string as an input, and it needs to predict the function body. And then in addition, we have a set of unit tests that help us verify if the solution that the model produced is actually the correct one. We compared against various open source models like the Llama models that have been quite active recently, or some closed source models like Palm or Code Cushman. Code Cushman is believed to be the model that powered at least the initial version of Copilot. And you can see both StarCoder and StarCoder Prompted are very good at that. Also, StarCoder Base is really competitive. The reason there is a prompted version is we found that the model sometimes refused to actually produce an answer and just put a comment as a placeholder saying the solution comes here. That probably comes from the pre-training data containing a lot of exercises and the human eval benchmark looking like one of these exercises. And we could fix that by specifically putting a comment at the beginning that this is not the exercise, but this is actually the implementation. And that's why we got a boost when we prompted it. I'm going over those. One thing that we found, which is quite interesting, is you can prompt StarCoder to act as a teaching assistant. So the way you do that is you provide the model in the context with a lot of examples of conversations between a human and an assistant. And then when you ask it a question at the end as a human and say, you're the assistant now, give me tell me what the assistant would say, it will try to produce something useful that an assistant would actually say. And you can see on the right an example of such a conversation where I asked it, can you give me the Python code that tells me the weather in the city of Bern? And the code that it produces does that. You can also see the PII at work in the middle somewhere. There's a API key equals, and there's a square bracket key. That's actually the placeholder that we used in the PII pipeline. So you can see the model. If we wouldn't have done the PII removal, it would have added a PII, a key, a real key there probably, or something that looks like a key at least. But that was very surprising that a model that we purely trained on code can actually, without any tuning, work as an assistant. Probably training on lots of GitHub issues also helps where you have these kind of conversations. Well, one thing that these LLMs can do is sometimes they can generate novel content. They can merge or fuse the training data and produce things that look new, but they can also create verbatim copies of the training data. Especially if you're training large models for a long time, they tend to memorize certain parts of code. And on the right-hand side, you can see such an example where someone used Copilot and they prompted it just with the function name, and it actually then produced like the whole function of their repository. And we tried to address some of these issues. As Sarm said, we excluded copyleft code, but even then, you want to do attribution when you copy code from certain places. And we created a VS Code extension that lets you do autocomplete, like you might know from Copilot. But in addition to that, we have a membership test. So you can run the membership test on the generated code, and it will tell you whether that piece of code was present like that in the pre-training data. On top of that, so the reason there's that membership test here is like it's very, very fast. The membership test doesn't tell you where the code came from, but it can tell you whether it was in the pre-training data in like milliseconds. So that's very handy for an extension where you can't wait for a long time. And if something was found, it will prompt you to the search index that we created on top of that. So that's a full text search index where you then, for example, can copy paste that piece of code, and you can then search where in the pre-training data did that occur. And that's also an app on Spaces that you can use. It's called that dataset search. And for example, here I gave the example of the famous inverse square root name. And then the search index returns the source of the repositories, the language, the license of that particular repository, as well as where in that piece of in that file it found that piece of code. And that's hopefully like a first step towards proper attribution, where you then can check where your code came from, and you can properly attribute if the model copy-pasted code verbatim. Another cool thing that you can do that Harm already showed a bit on the right is like use StoryCoder as an interpreter, but you can also use it inside Jupyter Notebooks because it was trained on Jupyter Notebooks. It can take the markdown as an input and then produce the corresponding code to that, which is a nice feature. And there is a Jupyter Notebook extension that you can install to use it inside Notebooks. The model comes with the OpenRail license. It's a royalty-free access. It gives you royalty-free access to the model. You're allowed to modify it and distribute derivatives, but it includes ethical use case restriction. For example, you're not allowed to generate malware using the model. A lot of criticism towards the early version of the OpenRail license is that it's very hard to commercialize, although it allows for commercialization. Adhering to the use case restrictions in practice is very hard. We made a lot of modification to the original OpenRail license that should make the commercialization now much easier and to follow to satisfy the use case restrictions. You can find the full license agreement under the link at the bottom. So with that, I would like to conclude the talk, and I think we still have a few minutes to answer a few questions. I see Harm has already been very active in the chat.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of activity, so happy to maybe, I mean, I'm not sure how much time we have, but there are probably like a lot of interesting perspectives here on this that like would be nice to hear from you and what you guys are thinking. I just like look at the chat. So what use such ethical clauses are for? You're forbidden by much harsher laws than copyright law to distribute malware. Does some criminal continue to distribute malware? Yes, I think, yes, so is again the question about like how enforceable are these, ethical use case restrictions? And like, I think these are just an ongoing debate, right? Like, to what extent? I mean, it's basically the way I think most people see it as sort of like a way to, encode a little bit the principles of the community, right? In terms of what these models should be used for, right? And we know these models are, very powerful and have a lot of impact on the workforce. Hopefully for good, but also like you don't want to make sure that malicious actors are not going to exploit it, right? And we understand that, and I understand that the question is like if the best mechanism is through the license. I think that's really an open question, and I think this is also like what the real license developers are trying to figure out themselves. So I think this is just like ongoing work on exploring that territory a little bit. Okay, next question. Well, I'm just going to skip the other topic, but are there any plan that the dataset will adopt copyleft code? So this is an interesting discussion, I think, as well. Like we initially excluded it because there was more pushback from that community on, like using their code and potentially like that things get copied over. But I think like now, I mean, the question is really like, what does the community think, right, in terms of, what do they find acceptable as sort of like the creators of that type of code? Would they like it to be included and then being part of the, like if we open source the model like we do right now, right, like is that useful? Like, is that something they support? Is there, there's a lot of open questions, I think, about like the opt-out, right? Like opt-out plus sort of like data inspection, right? Like the question is like, what kind of tools? Like I think like the licenses are a little bit outdated for sort of like this new era of LLMs. And the question is like, what kind of new tooling and licensing and whatever we need to develop to make this a more sustainable ecosystem, right? So I think the question is a little bit, what do you think would be a good mechanism for others to train these models and make sure that that the proper attribution is there and the right incentives?
I mean, in addition to that, right, at the beginning of the project, it wasn't also very clear how far we would get with like attribution tools. And I think once the attribution tooling gets better, probably also the community feels more comfortable if their code is used, if it's very transparent where generated code came from.
let's see. Are there more questions or?
Which permissive licenses did you choose to train the model? I think it's quite a long list right now. We use the definition or the recommendation of the, I think it's Blue Oak.
Council.
Which licenses were considered as like permissive. I mean, Apache 2.0 and MIT make up like the vast majority of the volume of data, but they're like, I think roughly 100 licenses included now. In the data set, there's a license file where you can see the full list. Oh, I can share the Jupyter Notebook expansion.
So I think we have time for one more question. And I think that'll just kind of be first come, first serve, whoever is the fastest typist here. and also Harmon, Leandro, if we could get you to stay for just like a minute after the stream stops, that would be great.
Sure. It's like nobody wants to go for the last question.
Yeah. We might have something here. Somebody's typing.
Lots of pressure for the last question.
Yeah, I know. Going once. Going twice. Michael's typing. He might have something. Yeah, we can see if Gimme is going to ask a question, I think. Okay, we do actually have one from IRC that I can pass on, which is, can an opt-in large language model work, in your opinion?
I mean, it's very difficult unless you are like already, I think, popular enough that you have like a massive reach. As you saw at the beginning when Harm showed the stack, we have roughly 100 million repositories or 150 million repositories that went into the stack. And like, ideally, we want more data rather than less to train these models. So we need like millions of opt-ins, which is very challenging at the moment to get like very good performance. Maybe if we get more data efficient algorithms, maybe at some point, but I think at the moment it's difficult, at least.
Yeah, just maybe to add, like, yeah, it's gonna definitely need more time. Like at the moment, right, like it's just hard to get a consent from so many people to train these models, but I don't want to exclude it as like a possibility. You know, if this is what everyone wants, if the society wants, I think, you know, it could happen. It's just gonna take a bit longer. Okay, I think that was the last question.
I think that was it. Thanks so much for the talk. It was great. We learned a lot. And yeah, thanks for sharing your project.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, everyone.